Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. The NAMM Foundation is working to assure that all children have the opportunity to learn and grow with music, and that music is part of daily living for everyone. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation. And you just won't believe who's here with me. I am here with Artie Kornfeld, who is was the music promoter of the Woodstock Festival, but is also a legendary songwriter, producer, music promoter. Welcome, Artie Kornfeld.
Yeah, I'm the co-creator, the sole producer, and the guy who put the movie and record deal together 4 days before the concert.
And yeah. That too.
Well, yeah. I had a lot of experience. I knew people in the business. My first record was 58.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to all the details about Woodstock, and I've got some questions about that. But I really want to, I was fascinated by your bio that you started out as actually a classically trained trumpeter.
Oh, yeah, I was all state first year solo in the 10th grade.
And where was that?
In North Carolina.
In North Carolina.
Yeah.
So you came out of a pretty good music program in school.
Well, I lived in New York, they came out. My father was a policeman in Brooklyn, where I come from. And then we moved to a place in Long Island, and like Levittown. Everybody knew about mm-hmm. Levittown. And they came out with a program for $1 a month. You got an instrument and a lesson every month. And I wanted to be a drummer so bad. And they were out of drums, and all I had left was one cornet. You know, and I picked it up, and I was gone. I mean, I was gone. I was gone into playing trumpet. It was great. It's a great trip, being a trumpet player. But you know what? I got mononucleosis. I couldn't play for like a year because it had after effects. And I had an old Rafael Mendez. And Rafael Mendez, if you know Spanish classical stuff, he was the best. And I had the Bach mouthpiece, and I had I was in the studio doing a session, and most people would know Clark Terry because he's the guy that played all the leads that Doc Severts took credit for. And I was in a session, and it was a break, and I asked Clark, could I have your horn for a minute, Clark? He said, sure, Artie. And he said, you're the guy paying by the hour. And, you know, so I picked it up, and I tried a C scale, and I couldn't even get through a C scale. Yeah. And I said, here, Clark.
But you were in school, and you had a good school music program.
And
this was the basis.
Oh, and then I had Johnny Hodges, the famous jazz musician, teach me breathing and diaphragm control.
Yeah, but that school music kind of was the base for everything, wasn't it?
Well, I wasn't going to play an accordion.
So you probably could have, but you didn't want it, right?
Yeah, no, I wanted to be a drummer. I really did. Right. I had a lot of anger in me.
But we're talking, you know, our podcast is about music education. And you're known for so many things and so much success and influence in the industry. But here's one of the first stories of music in your life is that you were in a good school music program.
Yeah.
And you had a chance to start that way.
Yeah, and also on my own, I would practice 3 hours a day.
Because it was a passion. You felt the passion.
Yeah, I loved playing the trumpet,
So how far did it take you? You were in the honors band.
Well, after I made all state, you know,
yeah.
First chair solo, that's hard. You know, if you start out at fourth chair and you go to third chair and then you go to second chair and then you go to first chair and then you go to solo. It's a long climb if it's a big symphony. And I got really good at it. I could play all the songs that I heard on the radio. I couldn't match Bunny Berrigan. I couldn't match Harry James. I was nowhere near that level, but I could match any senior and junior, obviously, because mm-hmm. I was only a sophomore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. Do you remember any teachers you had in that time period?
Well, Johnny Hodges, if you look, he's in the Jazz Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And he was a sax player, but I just got him to teach me breath control.
Yeah. So really good bass training as a child. You got lucky. You were in a place where there was music education. You got
And I lived, and also So I could see the new rock bands and the new rock acts. I got a job selling soft drinks when I was 13 in the Charlotte Coliseum. And it was really hard because had real steep steps and those buckets were full of ice. Yeah. And out in North Carolina is an alcoholic beverage control state. So people would come with a bottle and they, and so all I stocked was mixers because I had it down. And yeah, I always made the most bread because these people were drunk and they'd give you anything. I, you know, they didn't even look at what they said. Keep the change on a 50, you know, just to get a bottle of, you know, Schweppes.
And meanwhile, you were hearing all the best music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, a miracle happened. Where I became a rock and roller and why this happened is my dad, he was a New York City policeman. He turned down sergeant because he couldn't moonlight and have two jobs. And he had to have three to support us the way he wanted to support us. And my mother is the founder with Vernon Jordan of the Freedom Rides. And actually, in my book, there's a letter from the Congress for Racial Equality about my mother that they sent every member of CORE, where they basically said every Afro-American owes a big kiss and a thank you to Shirley Kornfeld because she pushed integration into college ahead 20 years.
That is so interesting.
And then she founded Save the Whales and Save the Greyhounds.
So that I'm getting a, that was very influential in your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Hugely, in terms of, and I'm talking about Woodstock now, in terms of being a moment of social change and a moment of social cohesion and a moment of social identity, right?
Well, I don't know. It was almost like I was groomed, like they were, but I was pushed. It's like, you know, I'm in North Carolina. I wasn't that religious, really, because my dad worked too hard to be involved in temples and stuff like that. I got bar mitzvahed. I'm Jewish. And I got bar mitzvahed because for my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing because we were broke and all these people came down from New York. And I didn't really go to temple. I really reject. I was a friend of John Lennon for about a year. And I sort of agree with him about religion, although I'm a firm believer in a power greater than myself, definitely. Mm-hmm.
It's just former religion.
Right. Yeah,
it's
well,
not such a pal.
Religion for, you know, pay to pray. I don't believe in pay to pray.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable, reasonable.
Yeah. Some people can
decision
afford it.
To reach at this point
yeah.
of life.
Yeah.
Right?
Don't tell me how to vote. Don't tell me this or that. You know what I'm referring to.
But going back to your what you're telling us about your mother, this was obviously. You grew up in a home with a lot of social consciousness.
Yeah, a lot of conflict, a lot of social consciousness,
right.
You know.
And it's interesting. We're going to come back to that a little bit when we talk about Woodstock. But I want to ask you, when you were, you know, again, coming up in your life, having access to music education, hearing all the you know, all the best sounds of the era when you were helping everybody have a good time in this music hall, right? When did the songwriting bug hit you? With these 75
I had a trumpet and I couldn't afford to have anything else. And it was really hard to write rock on a trumpet. Oh, I'll tell you why I got into rock. My dad was at the bus station for some reason at 3 a.m. and there was a big, heavy set Afro-American man sitting there. And my father brought him home. And I woke up in the morning, and there was Fats Domino sitting in our dining room.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah. You know, as it turned to be, I got to help Muddy Waters when he was in trouble, and Little Richard wanted me to do a documentary on him. And I got to know all those guys because that roots, which was down south, but it was also from Chicago, the blues. And I love Buddy Holly.
That was later in their life. This is when Fats Domino just came home. Your dad brought...
Oh, no, Fats Domino. I think I was 12 years old when I met Fats.
Your dad brought home Fats Domino.
Oh, yeah.
And then, how many people can say their dad brought home Fats Domino?
Oh, yeah. No, my dad was... he was probably the most giving human being I've ever met.
Yeah. That's remarkable. So did he stay?
Did he? Oh, he stayed 2 days.
Just to get himself together. And
yeah,
get back
right,
on his feet.
Right.
So then he was an influence for the guitar and other things.
No. This is the music that I heard in North Carolina in the 50s, you know. You know, I was hearing Arthur Smith and the Cracker Jacks. And then you started to hear a little bit of the Carl Perkins stuff, you know, creeping in.
There was a lot of influence.
And I fell in love with Buddy Holly stuff, you know.
Yeah. But there was a lot of things shaking your cage, though. I mean, if you were already musically gifted on the trumpet, your mom was a social activist. Your dad brought home Fats Domino.
Yeah.
I mean, that's early in your life. Well, that all these very interesting things were happening.
They put my sister and I through a very weird trip because I went to 16 schools from kindergarten to graduating high school.
Because they moved around so much.
So I was a new kid in school.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I was such a good lyricist.
Yeah.
Because I knew how to read people very quickly. And I knew what would turn them on. And I like to make people happy.
So songwriting. I'm going to go back and ask that question.
Oh, yeah.
When did that hit then? In your late teens, in your 20s?
I went to work and I saved up enough money to go buy an Ampex tape recorder, which was a box the size of this table. And it was just like a one track. It was like, but you could cell sync. I forgot how I worked it, but it worked. And I first song I played was Michael Row the Boat Ashore because I had a friend who was a folk singer.
Two chords or three chords?
Three.
Three, yeah.
You know, so anything in three chords I could play. Yeah, so
that's
usually,
like the most of us,
usually when
right?
I sing my songs that were hits that are six chords, because I had a co-writer, I play them in three chords or four chords. You know, so you could, I could play, I love Bo Diddley. So I play everything mm-hmm. to the Bo Diddley beat, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I could say, follow me, mm-hmm. I'm the Pied Piper. I wrote that song in 15 minutes and recorded it in 1 hour.
Oh. All right, so these things were just coming to you, songwriting, writing lyrics, writing melodies.
My mother loved Harry Belafonte and Odetta and those kind of people. And my dad loved opera, you know, and I just love music.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just the...
So you just took it to paper. You just started
writing.
Well,
it happened quick because my first record came out when I was in the 10th grade. Uh-huh. On Paramount Records. Now, I didn't even know that until someone on Facebook posted, because I decided to call myself Jess Wild.
Jess Wild.
Yeah, but I spelled it W-Y-L-D. By then I could play guitar. You know, it took me about 6 months to be able to write things with a guitar, maybe less. But... it just sort of came very natural to me. I listened, and then, you know, working in the Coliseum and hearing all the classic rock people from the beginning, from when it was rockabilly and when it turned to rock, and yeah, yeah.
This is, you sang so calmly, it just came very natural to me. 75 songs, yeah. Billboard rated songs. They all just came very natural
to
you.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm looking back and I'm saying, where did I get all the time to do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. That's a big body of work here.
Yeah,
and it all just came very natural to you.
I also produced about 45 or 50 albums during that period. So I was in the studio a lot. I found Debbie Harry. I produced an album called The Wind in the Willows, which is really quite, it's a Baroque.
Yeah.
It's The Hobbit.
Oh, I know.
Put to music.
Yeah.
And I loved Roger. Well, at that point, I had already run Mercury, and I put out King of the Road, because when Quincy Jones left, I was ahead of A&R, and I put out King of the Road, and I got to hang with Roger Miller. What an experience.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm driving into these questions because part of our audience are also college music students and young people that want to work in the industry.
Yeah.
And when a lot of aspiring songwriters, a lot of aspiring producers, young, talented people. And, you know, we always try to share with them, with someone that's achieved as much as you have. You said it all came naturally. But I think, you know, you had good music training early.
Well, also, I was also a reader. I would be reading 3 books a week. When Christmas came around, or Hanukkah, whatever, people would give me books as presents.
So you're curious. You were very committed and curious.
Yeah, and it didn't matter what I read. And I got into listening to, you know, Juan Carlo Minotti, who wrote operas in English, you know, mm-hmm. the medium, you know.
The Consul.
Yeah, right.
I sang in that opera.
Really?
Yes. I won't sing it for you now, though.
Oh.
I was the only one in the opera that got to leave the country.
And I know what you're talking about because I listen to his stuff so much. He fascinated
me. The only one in the country that got to leave the country was my character. And the lead character stuck her head in an oven at the end.
A very weird opera. I know. That's a long time back. I mean, you're lucky because I only heard it. You know, I didn't see it. I never got to see it. You know, yeah, it's not like today.
Very dark opera.
Yeah, well.
But cool music. I enjoyed it.
Well, the music was a little dark, too, actually. Yeah.
Well, when the lead character sticks her head in the oven at the end.
Yeah, that's a little, you know.
Yeah, it's
But in Dead Man's Curve, you know, it came true. When I put that in, Brian Wilson was writing with me. And when I put in the accident and then, you know, 2 years later, what I wrote in Dead Man's Curve happened to Jan Berry, may his soul rest in peace,
yes,
who I love very much.
So when you say all these things come naturally, what you're also saying by saying you read a lot of books, you were always very disciplined and intellectually engaged, and you pushed yourself a little bit.
I did
not just a little bit.
I did it in athletics, too.
Yeah.
You know, I did. I led it in five sports in high school. I was a really good pitcher in college. I was the president of my class in college.
And you were number one in your college class, you said.
No, I wasn't number one because I didn't graduate. I left.
But you were number one somewhere.
Oh, well, no. When I left Adelphi University on Long Island, and I wanted to do international law. I felt it coming, what's coming now. And so American University had one of the top three.
In D.C., absolutely.
International law schools.
Yeah.
And they had a program, and I already had all these credits. And they had a program that if you did a semester, you can get credits towards your bachelor's, and you could also get credits towards your law degree. So I did a semester, but during that period, I really couldn't afford to live in Washington. So I started to work in the snack bar, and there was this heavyset girl who used to sit in the corner with a guitar case open and sing, and people were funny, and it was Cass Elliot.
Oh.
So I met Cass Elliot when she was about 18, and it's weird because I wound up being very involved with the Love and Spoonful and John Sebastian. And they were friends. It was just so strange, a circle.
Yeah.
You know, I said, "What? Remember the song? May the circle be unbroken."
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
It's really just, you know what? It's God's will.
Well, and a little bit of hard work.
A lot of hard work.
Okay, this is what I was kind of trying to pull out of you. You say, it just came natural. But all the story that everything you've said up until now has been a tremendous amount of personal initiative. You have been really out there working it and being a part of it and being open to people and engaging with other people and engaging with ideas. So I'm just, again, we're talking to other young people who might want to have a life in music or do their creativity or write their songs.
Right.
And you know, it is a gift, but it's a gift we have to use and work, right?
Yeah, it did work. I mean, I'll tell you an extreme. Just playing basketball against Roslyn High School on Long Island, I had to guard Michael Crichton. who wrote The Andromeda Strain and all this. Didn't he wrote The Andromeda Strain?
I think so. Well,
you know.
Yeah.
And he was big,
so
I did a terrible job guarding him. You know, I played Brooklyn street ball, so you know, watch out for your knees and your ribs when you come by me. You know.
Well, we have to get to the heart of our conversation, and I have a list of questions about Woodstock.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as I was kind of planning the opportunity to chat with you and meet you, and you know, all the wonderful things that you've contributed to our world and our culture, you know, Woodstock was a social phenomenon. My question is probably, like, Mary, you would say it's really not a very smart question, but this was the world that we live in now with cell phones and text and Instagrams and Snapchat and Facebook and the interactivity and the virtual communities. None of that existed when this thing happened.
Yeah. That's true.
What was the, when you look back on it now, and maybe you even had the same energy and understanding at the time, what was the core energy that just drove this impossible convergence?
Woodstock was easy.
To tell you the truth,
you know, I did a special promotion as a favor to Charles Koppelman, who was chairman of the board of EMI, but we used to play softball together. And he was the IV3. I'm a yogi baby. And I had a record. Jan and Dean put out a record, and I wrote one side, Dead Man's Curve. And the A side was called The New Girl in School. So I said to myself, I'm tired of hearing from these promotion people why something didn't happen. And then I hear it's playing in Chicago or Louisville, and I call and it's not getting played. So I said, I got to start learning about these stations. So I went into Woodstock knowing every FM program director in the country. And I said, you know what? I'm going to use the only media I know how to work, and that's press and the media.
And radio.
Radio is my
good key. Old-fashioned radio.
Oh, yeah, right. I brought in $1.5 million just about with one ad in newspapers and one commercial when we were going to go out of business on my anniversary to my late wife, Linda. May her soul rest in peace.
May God bless her.
Yeah. You know, I was happened as a writer, but it was very quick before I was already doing A&R at a company. Mm-hmm. You know, just very quick.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you galvanized the good old-fashioned radio for the promotion. You promoted the... was there something also that you think that generation of young people were just ready for and were yearning for?
Well, I knew that generation
because they'd been buying songs I wrote.
I knew what they went for. And I was lucky to be a Screen Gems writer with Donnie Kircher and Al Nevins and Barry Mann, and I went with Cynthia Weil and Jerry
Goffin.
But it
was just the music they came...
King.
Was it just the music they came for?
No. Woodstock.
All right, that's
Woodstock
what
Woodstock was my generation. For me, I was the only one of the three that did not do Woodstock for money.
Were they longing for?
I resigned from Capitol as senior vice president, to do Woodstock.
What were they longing for?
Well, we wanted peace. I had friends I played football with in high school. I had six guys I played on the line with, defensive line, that got shot. And, I was getting down in this war, and I was a history major. So, there was no reason. The French got killed, and it's like, why are my friends getting dead? And I guess a lot of people felt that. Why is my son dead?
So there was a longing to come together.
Well, yeah, we wanted peace.
It was big, and it was music, but it was music and that big idea.
Well, yeah, I remember the day, because I'm old enough that I remember the day that they put in the paper victory over Japan in World War II. And my dad was in a hospital in the Philippines, so it was like, I remember that. I remember the joy of having peace. And all of a sudden, we were thrown in, for what I thought were, totally bogus, commercial reasons and political reasons. And
so you were a
piece. It was a protest to me, Woodstock. It was come together, show let's the war babies. We are the largest generation in history because it was the war babies. And let's show them that we can unite and we do have some power.
And it still resonates through our generation. I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you, but not much. And I was just coming into my teens at the time of Woodstock. I graduated from high school in 71. So
when I graduated in 60, right?
Not far,
no,
you know, 11, not far off.
No,
and,
11 years.
And I, just young enough and just sort of old enough to go, to have those feelings and know that it was going on and understanding the music and loving the music, but feeling it in my gut. Why it happened. I just wanted to hear it from you.
Yeah.
Hearing it from you validates it for me, right?
Yeah. Well,
and why it continues to resonate. And I think, I'm a full-time advocate for music education, and I'm fighting for some of the goodness in life. And a lot of it comes from that gut feeling that I felt right then at that time in my life.
The songwriters that were around my age all of a sudden realized, well, maybe we should put something in our songs and we can make a difference. And then I heard Jesse Colin Young and I heard, come on, people now, smile on your brother.
Everybody get together.
And I knew Barry McGuire and I knew the writer Steve Sloan, then the Eve of Destruction came out, and I grew up with Paul Simon, and then the Sounds of Silence, mm-hmm. Was miraculous, and Bob Johnson, who produced, who did that, he's the one who did Johnny Cash and San Quentin, and wrote all those songs with his wife.
And it was all of those songs opened up things that were happening in our world that were never talked about or sung about in that way.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, well,
I mean, and I think there's pieces of it that have carried on.
Right.
I mean, there's in the artist community.
The Who said it, and I don't like The Who because I had an altercation with Peter Townsend at Woodstock. But, they said, we're not going to take it, never could and never will, They really said it in that song because of my mother and because of my upbringing. It was like, if we unite, we could take Richard Nixon on.
Well, yeah.
You know, yeah, because he did try to stop it. Yeah, it was trying to be stopped, and, you know, and I, you know, they, I mean, I had stuff planted in my office, things like that.
Well, you know, you started out by saying, well, Woodstock was easy. Well, like you said, writing songs, 65 plus songs, well, was natural.
I'm comparing it to the day I had to accept my daughter had died at 16. Woodstock was easy compared to that.
I agree with you.
But to tell you the truth, you know, honestly, getting Tracy Chapman and breaking the color barrier at FM radio with Fast Car and taking a folk song to number one on the rock charts, no record company, Charles Kaufman told Elektra, Jack Holzman, we don't want you to call one station. Artie's going to handle it. And I never promoted for anybody. And the guys who worked for me said Woodstock was not your best promotion. You know, Fast Car by Tracy Chapman was. And then I realized the sociological implications. So, I was aware of it the whole time.
Mm-hmm. But you know, Artie, to sit with you here is such a privilege for me, and I thank you for this conversation. But you have done some very difficult things in your life. You say it's natural. You say it's the easiest thing I've ever done. But at the end of the day, there were obstacles and all these things that you had to do.
Oh, are you kidding?
What I'm saying is that we appreciate the intensity and the commitment that you brought to these enterprises. Yeah. And I hope that there's a part of you that feels very good about your contribution.
It's so big and it's historical now. It's not a music business thing. It's in all the history books, and they start teaching it in America in the seventh grade.
Right.
It's in all the books.
Yeah.
So, you know, in reality, Mike and I and the other two partners that helped us start it, you know, and the crowd and we actually did make world history.
You did, Artie.
Yeah. It wasn't just
you did.
It wasn't just at the record and the movie, and I made those deals.
And you helped change a sensibility of an age that I think continues to move in the hearts of a lot of people.
Right. Yeah.
And I just want to say that.
Yeah.
And
I don't like that Woodstock represented a drug connotation, because that was not, there were people that came when we made it free, but those people always show up when something's free.
Right.
You know, and I had my battle, and I'm one of the founders of Cocaine Anonymous in 1983.
Yeah.
So I'm sober 35 years.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that.
Oh, well, I didn't make it yet. It's September 14th.
Yeah. Well, you will, though.
One day at a time, right?
Well, you will, though. Well, I can't thank you enough. Do you want to leave us with any final thought about what we should say to any young people and any teachers or communities about the role of music in their life and why we want every child to invest in the time to learn music? And
well, those who are making music, you really have to become objective about what you're doing. And you really have to find someone who's better than you that plays, or is in somebody, maybe a local band that's hot, and see their opinion on what you're doing to find out if you're even going in the right direction.
Good teaching, right? Mentors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
People that support you.
When I watched the Dick Clark show, every act, it was the pick of the show. I ran out and had the record in my house within 15 minutes. I'd run to the store, get the 45, and I had it. You know, like, but Peter, Paul, and Mary, well, you know, Paul was a good friend of mine, Noel Stogie. But, you know, I love rock and roll music, and I do. But, I love I Walk the Line, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to beat that.
Loving a lot of different kind of music, with all.
Well, you can't compare I Walk the Line by Johnny Cash to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Right.
You know, but in a way, I think Johnny, I was friends with, I knew McCartney and Lennon, I really think George Martin, the producer, is the guy that did the turnabout, because the electronics things he did that now they're doing with, I despise this electronic invasion that's taking away our privacy. You know, when a friend of mine tell me he's afraid to watch his TV because he just found out they have a camera that films you. And I guess that's for texting on the TV.
If you've got a smart TV and if you've got it on all the time, well, it's like your computer too, and you have to just manage your devices.
Right, and I miss good old honest AM radio and FM radio.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. Right.
Right.
You know, and thank God that, you know, actually the program director of Sirius XM is a friend of mine. And he used to do promotion for me, and Steve Leeds. And wow, I never really went to any of the cables. Yeah. Until I started to notice I was getting most of my royalties from cable systems.
And now they're your friends.
Well, it's amazing that BMI, you know, who I've been with since 1961, that BMI has collected over $1 billion 2 years in a row. Huh. When you think they'd be in the tank by now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think they solved that problem early on, and they've been very smart about that.
Well, you know, a hit song's a hit song, and that's gonna make you money for life. Like the Pied Piper I wrote in 1963,
mm-hmm.
and that song still comes in and actually sometimes pays my mortgage payment for the year.
Hallelujah!
Just that one song.
Remember that, all you future songwriters.
Well,
just
I take
remember
in my
that.
Groups. I've been in a lot of free concerts.
Yeah, we know.
When I ran Mercury, I mean, the company's just a freak. Why are you taking them a push act and showing them free to, you know? You know, someone would say the a guy, rich guy up in the Catskills is throwing a bee in, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I didn't do drugs before Woodstock. I really didn't. I smoked a little marijuana and that was it.
Yeah.
So it was a shock to me because I was exposed. And Michael and I were from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York. And we didn't know each other because he was younger. And it's just amazing. It's just amazing to look at the picture. I'm glad I lived the years I lived. I feel for the kids because I don't know where the world's going.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I also have great faith in our kids. I have a 25-year-old daughter. I'm so lucky to have her. And I have great faith in that generation, in those young people. Well, I think Artie Kornfeld and I could go on and talk about philosophy and life.
They did ask me to speak at the Sidwell Friends School in Washington.
Wonderful.
And they voted me the best assembly the SUNY school ever had.
Wow.
You know,
I'm not surprised.
Well, I was, you know, these kids were smart.
Yeah.
Because I take questions. I do 3 hours when I speak.
So then you should remember that and remember that's why I feel so positive.
Well, I couldn't answer their questions. They were too smart.
I feel very hopeful about because of who these kids are.
That's why I like to speak colleges and even high schools.
Because it gives something back.
I spoke to a group of Alzheimer's patients. If anybody calls and they need me, that's my job.
And I think we should end our conversation on that very generous comment that you made.
Oh, yeah.
Artie, thank you.
Yeah. It was real. It may sound like BS.
No, it didn't. You know. It sounded real to me.
Yeah, well, it is real.
So I thank all of you for joining us for this remarkable conversation with the legendary Artie Kornfeld.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you that we could have a cup of coffee together.
Yeah.
Sitting here at Summer NAMM in Nashville, Tennessee. And you'll be here. We'll be recording this and posting it to our podcast, Talking at Music Education, where we have a chance to talk to such people as Artie, who share his stories, his history, his commitment to a creative life and a life in music and all that you've contributed.
You didn't ask me what was it like hanging out with John Lennon.
Let's do that the next time.
Okay.
Okay. For our next conversation with Artie Kornfeld and for many more at Talking at Music Education, thank you for joining us. Thanks, Artie.
Thank you.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. Namm. That's Mary L. N. A. M. M.